This is GAA from Off the Ball.
We're getting very excited. We're taking over the airwaves from 7 a.m. all the way until midnight. There must be something big on, Joe.
It's the Dublin Drive for Five, Ger.
Six All-Ireland titles in 8 years.
This is OTB Sports Radio.
So the Drive for Five special continues. It's Johnny Ward standing in for the next hour, and I'm delighted to have a fellow Galway man beside me, a man that doesn't really need any introduction from all his years on TV. And Michael Lester, just before we came on air, we had a debate as to whether we were at the Galway Leitrim game in 1998, which started the whole thing. And I do remember now, even though I initially thought I wasn't, I was doing my junior cert the next day and we brought a busload and I was at the game. And I had two exams the next day, but we basically went to Carrick-on-Shannon because I think there was a buzz about Galway that year. But it's all about Dublin and Kerry this year.
It is, yeah. And by the way, we didn't have a debate about that because I knew I was in Carrick-on-Shannon because we were actually presenting the Sunday game from the venue on that particular day. But I was saying to Johnny earlier on, I know we're here to talk about a different match, but seeing that we mention it. And the funny thing about All-Ireland finals and stuff like that is that day in Carrick-on-Shannon, I think there was about 500 Galway people. Mm. And I would say to you that I knew about half them, because Pádraig Joyce had gotten onto that team from Killarearden. Mm. And of course all Killarearden was there to support him and all that kind of stuff. And then we get to later in the summer in the All-Ireland final, and now there's 50,000 people from Galway roaring and shouting for tickets and saying it's a disgrace how you can't get tickets. So some things never change.
It is a kind of a thorny subject. I know the Irish Times had an article on today how the distribution of tickets, and Tommy Walsh put it so well before the hurling final. It's hurling's day and it's football's day on Sunday, and you do have to honour the grassroots all over the country that, you know, give their heart and soul 365 days a year to the Gaelic Games.
You do, of course you do, but I mean the bottom line with it is any big sporting occasion is, on Sunday you will have 80,000 people plus there at the game. You could have 800,000 if they could get tickets to it. Mm. But unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. You know, somebody is lucky enough to get the tickets and somebody isn't. And the other thing that I have a bit of a gripe about is the complaints about people in the corporate boxes and all this kind of stuff. Now, I have to say, I've seen this myself. I've seen people at All-Ireland semi-finals and finals watching golf on the television while the match was on. But that's not the point. Mm. If somebody is paying good money for those boxes that's helping to pay for Croke Park, fine. I don't care what they watch.
Yeah. Have you been inundated with requests?
Ah, yeah, the usual kind of crack, you know. But in actual fact, the biggest bugbear for me, and this year has been no different, even though I'm not in RTÉ anymore, is getting people tickets for the Up for the Match programme. Mm. And that's even worse than trying to get people tickets to the Ireland. At least you can get 80,000 people into Croke Park. I think there's only an audience of about 300 or something like that in Studio One for that programme, or Studio Four. So, you know, and I say to myself, and I've done it again this year, why do I bother? Mm. But I end up doing bothering you. So, yeah. I suppose the other side of it is, Johnny, if nobody was interested, that'd be a different story, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and it's mentioned as well, they put up the tickets to €90. The hurling programme final for the final was €7, which I thought was quite steep. And when you have a situation where you have an All-Ireland semi-final getting around 34,000 at the game, you know, and if Dublin, you know, are striving for 6 in a row next year, it doesn't matter nearly as much as the historic 5 in a row. I don't think it would be quite as bad, but I don't think we should take it for granted. And I do feel that the attendances have been very worrying this year. I know Des Cahill was bigging it up on the ad on RTÉ, saying it's been a great football championship. I couldn't say it has been a great football championship. How would you assess it?
No, it hasn't been a great football championship. By the way, stand ticket for the 1982 Drive for Five by Kerry and Offaly, that match would cost you £8.50.
Yeah.
So, and obviously things move with the times. No, it hasn't been a particularly good football championship, but just actually referencing that year, 82, and in the build-up to that Kerry-Offaly final and all that, I was reading one of the articles that was in the newspaper at the time. I can't remember, was it Pather O'Brien or somebody like that? I can't remember exactly who wrote it, but one of the GAA journalists at the time saying that it had been a bad year for football in 82 and that basically the buzz was gone out of football and that hurling was taking over. Now, I suppose in the early 80s, hurling probably was, because of course you had Galway winning the All-Ireland in 1980 and then you had Offaly winning it in 1981. So hurling was on the up at that particular point. But anyway, this year's championship for me, there's two things about it. First of all, the fact that Dublin have so dominated the football scene for the last couple of years. That happens. It happened with the Kilkenny hurlers a few years ago, and they were doing the same kind of thing. So this is Dublin's era. Others are just not stepping up to it. Leinster is a disaster. There's really nobody in Leinster at the moment to challenge the Dub. So it's a free run, basically, out of there. The new quarterfinal format, or the league-ish kind of whatever, Super 8s, yeah. That's the problem with that, of course, is when the GAA decided to introduce this expanded championship in both the football and the hurling, they did it at the same time as reducing the time frame. So they bring the All-Irelands back by 2 weeks, and then they put more games into that period. And I just didn't get the logic of that at the time. And I think they know themselves that it's not right. But why they just can't go and sort it for next year, they're whinging on about, oh, well, we have to wait till it's approved by Congress and all this kind of stuff, you know. But anyway, look, that's a different kettle of fish. That won't matter on Sunday when everybody's at the match.
Yeah, the Drive for Five special is taking over OTB Sports Radio all day from 7 a.m. to midnight. We build up to the All-Ireland Football Final, and it's all thanks to Tech7. Simply take it and leave it. This is obviously a very significant All-Ireland for Michael Lesser, because he won't be in the box seat on RTE on Sunday.
At the moment, I'm not in any seat, by the way.
You don't have a ticket either.
I don't have a ticket yet, but I did this at the hurling final, and I was actually in a very good seat for the hurling final. I just wait, basically, until one of my mates kind of rings me late in the day and said, listen, the ticket is after falling out of me back pocket, and will you come? So
I got two tickets, and usually it wouldn't be too hard to get tickets, but this year is obviously a bit different, and I had to get my coffee machine fixed.
Yeah,
and I was being charged 170 quid, so I left this, and then 3 weeks later I came back, and I was kind of humming and hawing about the coffee machine, and we were sort of going here and there. I won't name the part of Dublin that he's from, but he said, if there's any way at all you could get me tickets. So I said, it shouldn't be a problem. So I was thinking I'd get 4 or 6 tickets in some shape or form, but I got 2. But I don't mind missing the game. If I were a Dublin fan, he says to me he hasn't missed games in years, I let him go. But what'll it feel like for you?
Do you know what? I mean, like, I was at the hurling final, as I said. And to tell you the truth, I actually had a great day out at it. Not that I wouldn't have had a great day out if I was presenting the Sunday game as well, but a different day out, because we all went down and we met in town, we all, myself and a few mates of mine, and we had a couple of pints before we launched ourselves up to Croke Park. And the other nice thing about it was, the last 10 minutes of that game, when it was inevitable that Tip were going to win it and the Kilkenny were fading off the scene of it, we just kind of gave ourselves a nudge and said, will we get out of here?
Did you leave early?
Left 10 minutes before.
Cardinal sin.
And all that. I've stayed, listen, over the last 35 years, I've stayed for the end of every match that I've been at, and then some. But we hightailed it out of there and went back to the watering hole again.
What were your special memories in terms of all the years you've been there? We mentioned 98. I mean, for me, that was, I was 15 years of age, and there was just something about that summer that Galway could be on the cusp of something, coming from Connacht having gone so long without winning anything, and it just had the whole county seemed to get behind it. But you obviously had an impartiality, which maybe meant that you had to put on the impartial face. But
that
98 must have been special as well, and also the manner of victory for Galway.
98 was special. It was special for all kinds of reasons. John O'Mahony, of course, had come in and taken over the Galway team, and he brought this dynamic to it that hadn't been there for a few years. In actual fact, I think it was 2 years before that, Galway played Tyrone in a league match in Tuam, and had they lost that match, they would have been relegated to Division 3 of the league. So that'll tell you the state that Galway football was in.
Yeah.
But then what happened was, when O'Mahony came in, and they started to put together this team of the new young faces, the Derek Savages, the Porrick Joyces, guys like that. But then they had the experienced guys as well.
Tomás Mannion.
From Shum.
Jaff Allen.
Jaff Allen, of course, And guys like that, you know. And you had it around the pitch. You had experience, and then you had the young faces that came into it as well. So the blend was right. And you had leaders and characters in that team as well, which you always need in a team. And it was the right blend. Everything fell together in place, if you like, and all that kind of stuff.
I remember when they won the second All-Ireland subsequently, 2001, and I remember reading the Irish Independent the following day, and whoever wrote the article said Galway are on the cusp of dominating Gaelic football. And
that's right, I remember that. Yeah.
I think it took them, I don't know how long it took them to actually win a championship game in Croke Park after that. It took them years and years and years. It's a crumb of comfort that all dominance does end. You reference Kilkenny thing. My problem with Dublin is that if you do look at population and you look at the strength of Gaelic games in the county, I think people genuinely are worried for football. I put the problems football face now entirely down to Dublin's dominance and very little else. I think as much as the game has gone defensive, you know, Mayo and Dublin was a defensive first half. It was absolutely engrossing.
Sure, sure.
The problem was it was the most ruthless suppression of a rebellion ever. It was 5 minutes second half, done. And I think people are just worried, when is this going to end?
Well, look, I can't tell you when it's going to end, but I can tell you that it will end. Because, as I said to you before, that's the nature of things. You can look around the world and you look at various sports and you see it in them. You see it, for example, in soccer, Manchester United. They couldn't go through a season without winning at least two or three trophies. And like everybody else was just kind of playing catch up. Now they're struggling to win anything, basically. They're struggling to win their last two matches for a start. And that happens. Kilkenny, we referenced as well. Michael Schumacher turned Formula One. It was actually peculiar to watch a Formula One race that you actually fell asleep with fast cars making a lot of noise going around the circuit. But you could manage it with Michael Schumacher. And then his era passed. So it goes like that. It goes in phases very often. And we're going through this phase in football at the moment with the Dubs. But they're on the road for a long time now. Apart from these four All-Irelands that they're after winning back-to-back and possibly another one coming up next Sunday. But they're there with Jim Gavin and that era. And Jim will not be there forever. Whether he's there next year or the year after, he's not going to be there in 15 years' time or whatever the case is. So you just sometimes you have to say to yourself, A, OK, this is what's happening and this is where we are and we can't do anything about how good the Dubs are. But I think a lot of counties have to start looking at themselves around the country and saying, are we stepping up to the mark? Are we doing the best that we can? Because the gap between some of the counties and somebody like Dublin or a Kerry, for example, it's growing and it's growing. And I'm not quite sure just how you're going to stop that. Leaving Dublin aside for the moment, some of the other gaps that are appearing in the football scene or the hurling scene. I mean, you look back, we referenced a few minutes ago, awfully back in the day, that 82 final, like the hurlers were big in those days as well. They had won the All-Ireland the previous year. Jeez, but now, could you imagine awfully winning an All-Ireland hurling title at the moment or a football title?
Well, professionalism comes at a cost in that you look back at the footage of Antrim and Offaly in 89, was it? And, you know, it's amazing to think that Antrim could even win, you know, a semi-final. Yeah. But the physique of the players, it was so far removed from anything remotely professional. So the likes of Leitrim now in football, you know, the prospect of them beating Galway is almost completely obsolete. Yeah. And if you are a Leitrim footballer, I remember I was very friendly with a Leitrim footballer living in Dublin, and I was very friendly with an Offaly footballer who was on the cusp of the panel. Yes, what's your motivation? Because you give up your life, essentially. And I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, and the problem about it is, and again, I hate to keep reference other types of sports, but there is a trend there across the board, and it's there in Gaelic games. The fact that counties who are more prosperous and who have the money to put into facilities are doing that and they're benefiting from it, but other counties aren't, either can't or aren't putting in the money. I was down a couple of weeks ago. I called in to see the Kerry training facility, which is
just down. That's in Corrins, isn't it?
That's in Corrins, yeah, just down the road from Farnforth Airport there. Oh, jeepers, it's absolutely magnificent. Mm. I mean, it's really state of the art kind of stuff. And there are other counties around the country with the money to put those kind of things together. They have it up in Tyrone, for example, Mayo have a good one, etc., and so on. But every county can't do that. And you must be at that standard, or otherwise, you know that saying, if you stand still, you go backwards. And there are a lot of counties standing still.
I don't think Gavin gets the credit that he deserves because, a bit similar to Brian Cody, he's overseen an impeccably big squad as well of players, but he can only pick 15. That's and he has to keep them happy.
Yeah,
and he's delegated responsibility to these guys, and even if you speak to a Dublin player, none of them will have a bad word to say about Jim Gavin. And Declan Darcy, who would have been playing for Leitrim in those
days, right,
I remember scoring an outrageous goal in Tuam in 95 maybe
that
in 92
right. Yeah,
but he was making the point, like, what's the point of balling like David Fitzgerald on the sideline? It's only going to work for a couple of minutes. And the article started with, you know, I'm not trying to put down David Fitzgerald, they're calm, collected, and I wonder at half time against Mayo, was there even any murmur of discontent in that dressing room?
Well, you see, everybody has a different personality and they bring different dynamics to it. And some people are very vociferous and they're very emotional, and Davy Fitz that you mentioned and all that. Some people can fill at you in a much quieter sort of way, but the effect will still be the same. And like the thing about it is with Jim Gavin and this Dublin team, people are saying, Ash, of course, sure, Dublin, look, they have the pick of the world and they have, like, 55 million footballers they can pick for. The same kind of thing was there with Galway back with O'Mahony in the day. Everybody was saying afterwards, ah, sure, Jill, of course Galway wouldn't. Sure, cripes, and they had this, wasn't he lucky enough to have this bunch of young players? You can have talented young players in any county, but if you haven't the management there to nurture them and guide them and bring them to their potential, then they ain't going to turn out to be much anyway. So what Gavin has done with Dublin is absolutely fantastic, and what he's, and look, to bring a population, a football population, from various sides of the Liffey together and to coordinate them and to make them coherent, that's a job in itself, because there was a time when people were saying, oh, Dublin should be divided into two counties. And then there was a time before that people were saying, well, unless you were playing for St. Vincent's, you had no business being on the Dublin team and things like that, you know. So there are all kinds of dynamics that go on to making a successful team. As we've been seeing in the last week or two down in Galway with Micheál O'Donoghue and that kind of stuff. You know,
you're actually, I was going to bring that up with you because of our, obviously, our allegiance, but what's your take on it? It's hard to, I suppose it's hard to sit back and not be just wondering what actually is going on here, because the rumours are this and that. And, you know, I don't think anyone in Galway wants Micheál O'Donoghue to have left the helm.
No, I don't think so. And I don't think the players do. And I suppose, Johnny, we can't sit here and tell people definitive what's going on in the Galway setup, because there's Dúirteáin Lomga, Dúirteáin Lake kind of stuff going on and all of that. But definitely there is a tension between Micheál and members of the Galway board. And this is part of the reason, if not the main part of the reason, of what's going on here. And the feeling in Galway is that the money hasn't been put in, as I said a moment ago there, about the facilities and the...
Well, you referenced the current training camp. Obviously, Galway got their collars burnt by, you know, going for a facility. And they've probably been reeling for ever since from that, really, financially.
They have been. And I mean, look, let's face it, that was just unfortunate. Unfortunate in the sense that they were doing at the time what they thought was possible, and it was just wrong time, wrong place. And
absolutely,
they got, as you said, they got burnt. Okay, look, at those things happen. But if those things happen, you then have to work double hard and double fast to fix them. And this seems to be the issue there.
What would you like to see happen?
This is one for Micheál. But I think if he changed his mind and was persuaded back, I think everybody in Galway hurling would be happy with that situation. And I think then you could drive on, as in say, look, there was a bit of a bump there, but he's back, we can sort this out, we can focus ourselves at 2020 and let's see what happens. If he doesn't change his mind, if he decides, no, look, at I've seen the setup, I know where I'm at, and I'm prepared to step back from it, then we look at where we go after that. Is it Jeff Linsky who's going to take over Brian Handley? You know, I mean, that's the big decision that has to be made, or somebody from the outside, which is probably not going to happen. But look, there's a lot of questions to be answered between now and the end of September, or whenever the decision will have to be made, or probably sooner than that. I think this one needs to be kind of nipped in the bud, as in it's getting a little bit too much talk and too much, as I said, well, you know what's happening in the background there, kind of. You know, that's no good for any county.
There was a strange statement in that it didn't contain anything apart from a few sort of nice words from the county board today, which only really added to the mystery. But we will move back on to football. Just some of your memories. I grew up listening to you, obviously, and we were always proud from North East Galway that somebody from North East Galway was the face of RT. You know, Jim Carney would have been from Tuam, a great, great man as well. You know, you could write a great book on your days and the people you dealt with and the people you met and the matches you saw.
Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah. And I mean, the thing about just mentioning Jim, when Jim left the Tuam Herald, he was a reporter in the Tuam Herald.
Did you do your stint there?
I replaced Jim.
Right.
In the Tuam Herald. And then I replaced Jim on the Sunday game. So there was a kind of a symmetry to all that kind of thing, if you like.
Conveyor belt going backwards and forwards.
Exactly, yeah. And to be honest with you, I would never have got my chance on the Sunday game, except Jim had a very bad car accident.
Yeah.
He went back to RTE, he went back to the Sunday game and Gaelic games and all that for a while, but then decided it wasn't for him going forward, and he stepped out of that, and then came the task of replacing him, and that just... I happened to be lucky enough to be the one that did, you know. So that was the beginning of it from my point of view.
Where did you study in terms of journalism, or how did you get into it initially?
I went to St. Jarlath's in Tuam, and
as did many greats before and after.
As did many people, yeah, great and otherwise. Yeah. And then after I finished in St. Jarlath's, there was an opportunity for me, family connections, to work at the sugar factory in Tuam. I did actually work in the sugar factory for a short period of time. And look, you know, that was there, and this was my career if I wanted it going forward. But I saw an ad for a junior reporter in the Tuam Herald one day, and I applied.
Could you write?
I applied and I got it, yeah. Let's put it that way. I brought in actually a couple of articles that I wrote for the St. Jarrett's magazine that obviously Jarrett Burke, who is the editor of the Tuam Herald, thought that it's half coherent anyway. The only thing, I think I could write, yeah. I think I could write. I couldn't spell, but I could write. And you, in those days, you'd hand your copy up to the editor. And I can still, to this day, hear Jarrett Burke reading through my stuff and go, oh, gee. C-A-T-T, cat, oh crap, you know.
Yeah, but, come a long way, Michael. Yeah.
you see, you don't have to be able to spell anymore. This is a great thing that advanced my career. If your typing's on the computer, it just fixes the spellings for you.
Well, presenting isn't, it's not easy, you know. It's something that I think people can do or people can't do. And how did you take naturally to it, or did it take time for you to kind of warm to the role?
I think I took naturally to it because I started off in Radio Sport, and I was in Radio Sport for 4 years. 4 to 5 years. And then when I found myself in a television studio, how I got into television was, I was working in Radio Sport one day. TV and Radio Sport were separate in those days. They were in different parts of the complex out in Donnybrook. But I got a phone call across from a guy called Maurice Reedy from Castle Island in Kerry. And
lovely man, actually.
Yeah, good guy. Very good guy, actually. But he said, did you ever consider doing any bit of television stuff? And I kind of said, you know, well, yeah, but, you know. He said, yeah, well, you know, he said, we want a second presenter on Sunday Sport at that time, which was the winter time before the Sunday game started.
What year are we talking here?
And Fred, we were talking 1984. Yeah, 1984. Four. Fred Cogley was the presenter of it. And they said, we want somebody else to come in and do the other sports news of the day, apart from whatever the main event that we're covering and all that kind of thing. And I said, you know, yeah, I'd certainly consider that. I said, when are we talking about? Thinking that he'd be saying next month or 6 weeks' time or whatever. And he said, a Sunday, actually. And I'm thinking, okay, this is Thursday. And I still to this day remember the first thought in my head was, now remember at the time, I'm a single man living with two other lunatics in a house in Killiney. I'm thinking,
it shall not be named.
Have I got, who shall not be named? Yeah. Vincent Hogan might have been one of them for all I know, but anyway.
Another of the greats, yeah.
But the first thing I'm thinking to myself is, do I actually have a clean shirt? And then I'm thinking, do I actually have a shirt? Mm. And on a Sunday night, I found myself in this studio. I had never been in a presenter's chair in a TV studio. And I guarantee you, folks, it is one thing to be a radio presenter, and that's tricky enough, and that requires a skill. TV is a completely different
thing. See the nation looking at you.
Altogether. Yeah, and there's other things going on that don't happen necessarily in radio. There's a guy in front of you making signals and all kinds of things with headphones, and other guys going around the background, and cameramen, and blah-de-blah. I mean, there's just two of us sitting in this studio. Now, we know the guys are looking after us from outside there, but you're in the studio, and all this stuff is happening around you. And I'm looking at Fred Cogley, and we're talking about rehearsals here before we went on air. And Fred's doing his stuff, and he's doing his rehearsals. And at one stage, I looked down, and he lifted his hand off the desk to get a piece of paper, and he left a sweat mark on the desk. After him. I looked at it and I said to myself, okay, I'm not that nervous.
Yeah.
And then I don't know why that just kind of psychologically relaxed me. And then I just quickly kind of got into the feeling, I can do this. Now, I didn't necessarily get into the feeling I could do this well, but I just got into the feeling, do you know what, I think I could actually handle this.
And you got into a rhythm.
And I got into a rhythm. What I didn't know at the time was the reason that they were asking me to do this little slot to see, would I cut it as a presenter, because they were then looking for a presenter for the Sunday game. So that was the trick there. So I did a few Sundays, and then they said to me, listen, we're looking for a presenter for the Sunday game. Are you interested? Mm. Wow.
Yeah.
So that was it, yeah.
In terms of the people you've worked with, who did you really rate as a sort of an analyst? You know, we've had a lot of big names, fixtures down the years that have been there for so long, the likes of Colm O'Rourke and all that, but who did you kind of rate in terms of, I suppose, their intellect and their delivery and all that?
I'm not dodging this question, but I'm slightly deflecting it in the sense that I think we've been very fortunate to have a very high calibre of analyst on the programme down through the years. It would actually be a bit unfair of me to say this guy was better than anybody else or whatever. Like you mentioned Colm O'Rourke or Pat Spillane or guys like that. Fellas that were there when I started off, pretty much, kind of, not necessarily when I started off, but came into the scene fairly quickly as soon as they retired from the inter-county scene themselves. And Cyril Farrell on the other side of it then, and the hurling and all that kind of stuff. You know, so they're the kind of stalwarts of it, if you like. But over the years, we've then brought in new faces and new people and all that. And I think 90% of them have added something to the whole dynamic of it and to the whole equation and all that. And a great bunch of people to work with. And genuinely they are, because one of the great things about the panellists that we've had down through the years is whether you agree with them or you don't agree with them, whether you agree with Joe Brolly or you don't agree with Pat Spillane or whatever the case is, they are articulate, they are intelligent and they are knowledgeable. And you cannot question any of those things. You might not agree with their opinions, but you can't question the way that they've expressed them. And the argument that they can back them up with. If you've got analysts like that, you're in a good place.
Was Joe Brolly the most challenging of the people you've dealt with?
Yes.
Why?
Because he's such a loose cannon, Joe.
Hard to handle.
And hard to handle. By the way, just to make it clear, I get on very well with Joe, so there's nothing, like, trust me, there's nothing personal. He's a great guy. But he's like a jack-in-the-box going around the place, you know. And you're trying to go through, before you get on the air with a Sunday game, go through all that mechanical procedure that I mentioned a moment ago of the rehearsals and things that need to be done. And you need your analysts to be concentrating on the gig at hand and listening to you and all that. But one Sunday, he came in to the studio in Croke Park, and the first thing he did was he put his bag down and he started doing press-ups. And I'm looking at him, I'm thinking, what is he doing? And like other days, he'd come in, he wouldn't let the makeup artist comb his hair because he didn't like the comb or something, you know, and this kind of thing is going on. So you would be coping with all these kind of things, sometimes just exasperated with it, and sometimes actually kind of half giggling to yourself because there would be a funny side to it. But the thing about it is, and this is to come back to my point, you knew that when you went on air, you got a performance out of him. You knew you got something out of him. You knew that you hadn't somebody sitting there that you were saying to yourself, jeez, would he ever say something?
Kind of, is Joe about the performance though, than what he's actually saying?
No, I think that probably would be unfair to him.
And he's a very intellectual
guy. He's a very intellectual guy, and he's very knowledgeable on football. I mean, Spillane, O'Rourke, name anybody you care to name. They do the homework. And doing the homework means sometimes sitting at home with DVDs, going back through matches, we'll say coming up to the big match on Sunday and all that kind of thing, studying form, studying tactics, studying players. You have to put that in before you can go on the air and say, here's what I think about this. This is what I spotted out of this game or that game or whatever the case is. You know. So look, I can guarantee you they put the work in. Whether you sometimes might want to throw something at the television, they put the work in. Don't worry about that.
Or throw something at them when you're there.
I think a lot of people would throw things at the television, except televisions are very expensive these days.
Yeah. A reminder that the Drive for Five special is taking over OTB Sports Radio all day from 7 in to midnight. With build-up to the All-Ireland Football Final, it's all with thanks to Tech7. Simply tech it and leave it. In a moment, Michael and I will be joined by Mike Quirk, who hopefully will give a positive bulletin about the vibes in the kingdom. But before that, his fellow county man, Darren O'Sullivan, gives his memories of the 2011 final between Kerry and the Dubs.
I'll never forget that day, hearing it when the ball hit the ground. And you could feel it.
Yeah.
You could feel it, like, and you could feel their confidence grow, the crowd starting to believe. And I was just starting to, you know, get on ball, and then there was the free, which seemed to take an eternity. And then all of a sudden it was over. And you're like,
yeah. It wasn't long after the free it was over. I watched it back this morning.
Yeah,
like, it was pretty much a kick out where ye all retreated back.
Yeah.
I know you were on the bench at that stage, you'd come off, but ye all retreated back.
Yeah, but one kick pass from Kerry and they could have been well inside or half if Joe McQuillan had given another 5 or 10 seconds, which thank God he did.
Fair play to you, you're admitting it.
No, it was over the 2 minutes of injury time at this stage, so he's well within his right.
Yeah, but it was just about a minute and a half to walk up and kick the ball.
Yeah, well, Bernard and was more. Waving him down. Yeah.
But like that's the thing, like, I suppose that was probably the start as well of the goalies coming up to take kick out or taking free kicks.
It felt like a very novel thing.
Yeah, I was like, geez, what's going on here?
Yeah.
But like nowadays it would be added on because it's more common and stuff. But I just remember, like, even after the game, it's over, and Dublin is celebrating, and you're just sitting there on the pitch and you're looking around like, going,
yeah,
what's just happened? Yeah. Like, because it's just
not meant to happen to us.
Yeah.
I'm sure Stephen wasn't touched from the goal line to getting the ball to hit the free, whereas on Sunday, if the same thing happened,
oh, he'll be hit all right.
A few lads chatting helping to him and helping him up and that type of thing. So.
And that was Darren O'Sullivan speaking earlier. We're now joined by Mike Quirk. Mike, we are building up to the game. We've only, what day is it? Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. This time, Sunday evening, we will just about know whether the five in a row has happened or will something else have happened.
Replay a week later.
90 quid a ticket as well, that'll do.
Yeah, they'll surely bring it down to €89 for the replay. So, I don't know, man, it's great. Yeah, look, there's like, obviously, like what you're doing. I don't know how much coffee has been drank over there today because it's a long shift. But like, there's a real buzz kind of down here now because everyone kind of appreciates how kind of momentous this final, you know, could possibly be. One way or the other, the winner is going to make history one way or the other. And I think it's been a bit of a slow burner, but now, you know, the people in Kerry and where I'm based, like, you can really see that people are talking about going up, you know, tomorrow morning for a game that's starting on Sunday. And it's just, it's there and it's building now because there's a little bit of optimism now that starts to creep in around now.
Mike, hi, it's Michael Lester here. One thing that struck me, I was down in Kerry last week. I was in Killarney at the races and talking to people down there and talking to football people. The one vibe that I got of it was more hopeful than bullish. You know, you said there's an optimism about it. There always is in Kerry about stuff. But I just do think that there's a realisation there that this is going to be tough.
Oh, no question. Yeah, I mean, look, if you see Kerry in an All-Ireland final, then it's 5-1, like, outsiders to win a two-horse race. I mean, they're incredible odds, and it probably tells you everything that you need to know about the final. And it's very rare that Kerry supporters or footballers or any team go into a final being such an overwhelming underdog and without any of your, you know, Yarra and play it down. Like, you are the second best team in this final, according to the bookies and according to the most pundits. So it will take one of those kind of very, very special days of football from Kerry, where Dublin have to play a little bit below themselves and Kerry have to play above maybe what we've seen so far. And, you know, like, you can't, that's why we play the game. You know, you can't count that out, and the possibility is still there. And I think, like, a lot of Kerry people, you know, when Kerry played that first half against Tyrone, you know, I was at the game the previous night again when Dublin absolutely obliterated Mayo in about 15 minutes after halftime, and I left the game. I remember telling the lads, I met Bomber, and we walked down to Potts's place there, the Piper's Corner, whatever, for a cup of coffee, and we were depressed walking out of the ground at how good Dublin were, and you were saying why are Kerry and Tyrone even playing tomorrow, because this crowd is so far ahead, and yet when Kerry produced that second half against Tyrone, that optimism just starts to build slowly, and the closer you're getting to the game, you start throwing out these things like, well, you know, who do they have to match up with Tommy Welsh, and David Moore's playing the best football of his life, and Clifford is, you know, so you start giving yourself hope. And look,
you do, Mike. But the problem about it is, Mike, if and Johnny, that you referenced there, if Kerry play against Dublin in the first half the same way they played against Tyrone, this game will be over very fast.
The game could be over in 10 minutes, Mike.
That's the thing.
Even though Mayo obviously managed Dublin well in the first half. The one thing, Mike, Kerry have to have belief, because most teams go out and play Dublin and don't believe they can win. Do you think Kerry, with their DNA as it is, do have that belief that they can damage them and beat them?
I think that's probably the difference between, you know, Kerry this year maybe and Tyrone going into the game last year. I know while Kerry obviously have more dangerous forwards there in O'Brien and Clifford and Ganey and, you know, Shawnee Shea, and even Killian Splann is a guy who can chip in and be dangerous. But I think that's the one difference between all those other teams. Even Mayo, as good as Mayo have been, Kerry will actually go into this game believing that they're the ones that are capable of stopping Dublin. There will be no kind of inferiority complex. Most of these guys haven't even, you know, played against this Dublin team, like Clifford and all the rest of them haven't faced this in championship level at this real top level, because, you know, his first year last year they were beaten by Mayo, obviously. Or sorry, they got out, you know, they didn't even get out of the Super League. So this is a new kind of environment for them. And a lot of these guys, Shawnee Shea and these fellas, there's an ounce of fear in these fellas, and they will believe that if they get enough stuff right to go for them, that they have a chance. And while, you know, I was focusing on the first half against Tyrone, like, if Dublin come out and play like they did in the first half against Mayo, and Kerry play as well as they're capable of, they'll be up far more than the 2 points that Mayo were up for half time, and they'll need to, you know, if you get into a situation here where Kerry find themselves 4 or 5 points up at half time, now it's a very different scenario, because now you have the luxury of introducing Tommy Welsh and Sherwood and all these guys to match up with the Dublin subs. And look, Kerry have to max out here, lads. That's the bottom line. Like, they have to get every single thing right and hope the Dublin are a little bit off. And I still think that ability is in them more so than any other team in the country.
They have to get everything right, as Mike said. But the thing about it is, Johnny, which we always have to put into the equation here with matches like this, it's the unforeseen. The thing that you can't predict, as we saw in the hurling final. Kilkenny needed everything to go right for them, I believe, simply because Tip were a better team. And what happened? They have Richie Hogan sent off in the first half in a controversial scenario. So these are the things you don't know here on a Thursday evening. Some one little flash like that in a match can change everything, as Mayo discovered a couple of years ago in the replay.
Mm, and I think Mike, you make a great point there about the lack of experience of some of these lads, particularly Clifford playing against Dublin, because the Mayo game, from my perspective, Mayo were trying to out Dublin in the first half, where they were just playing, if we have the ball, they don't have the ball, and they were so methodical going into the forward line that it did kind of slow the game down, whereas you don't see that with Kerry, because they have those dangerous forwards who don't play with fear.
Yeah, and that's the crucial thing. I mean, Mayo's game plan, while, look, it's always been that way, as good as Killian O'Connor and as good as Andy Moran have been for so long, they still don't have the kind of that real dangerous high-end kind of forward, the likes of Clifford and Shawnee Shea. And even, you know, Stephen O'Brien is playing the best football of his life, and he's a nightmare matchup for anybody. And you twin, like Ireland finals, like Michael mentioned there, the unknown. A guy like Killian Spillane, I just, the closer it gets to the whole thing, Killian Spillane is probably going to get picked up by the sixth best Dublin back the next day. Mm. You know, all the other guys are going to be the key matchups. And someone like Spillane is the kind of a guy that after the game, people could be talking and saying, geez, he chipped in with three massive scores there, and he got himself, you know, 50 minutes of great football, 3 points from play, did his job and came off the pitch. And it's those kind of unforeseen things that you don't see on a Thursday afternoon that possibly on a Sunday after the game we're all wasted. But I just think the crucial part of it, and again, being very aware that Dublin are capable of blowing Kerry out of the water here, like, but the difference is, I just think those Kerry forwards are very different to what Mayo have available or what Tyrone have available, who are very dependent on McShane or Matty Donnelly. You've a couple of guys who can go mad, and Clifford is capable of kicking 1-5 or Shawnee Shea 1-3, or, you know, so you've got these guys that are far more dangerous than any other team that Dublin will play, and it's not about containing the Dublin. Kerry have to go and outscore them, and they have to go and really attack the game from a forward point of view, and I think that's why people are really kind of looking forward to this so much, because you know it's going to be kind of, if not all out attack, pretty 90% that this is about outscoring our opposition as opposed to try to stop the others from scoring.
There's no doubt that Kerry have some of the finest forwards in the country at the moment, and people down
some
there
some of the finest
rightly,
forwards you've ever seen, probably.
Exactly, are rightly excited about them. But my query to you is, like, about the Kerry defence, because as we all know, Dublin will attack you at pace and relentlessly. Are Kerry capable of surviving that?
Yeah, sure. That's the big question, really. And like, realistically, you're looking at some of the matchups for Kerry, and you're being hopeful rather than you're expecting maybe the result. You know, and the likes of Tadhg Morley is playing some really good football at fullback, but like Conor Callaghan is going to test him out to an unbelievable degree. And he's a guy. The frightening thing about the likes of Conor Callaghan and even Paul Mannion, maybe to a lesser extent, is they don't want to go for a point. They want to actually go at you every single time they touch the ball. They're relentless in their approach at attacking for goals. And like, that's your fear, is can those crucial matchups, like probably be Jason Foley maybe on Mannion, you know, Morley on Conor Callaghan, maybe Tom O'Sullivan, who's having a great year, maybe outside on Kieran Kilkenny, Gavin Crowley maybe on Dean Rock. Like, you're hopeful in most of them, but you're not expecting that those guys are gonna shut the forwards down. And that's why I think it's Dublin, like, you have to put into your head here that Dublin are going to score 120. You know, that's what you're hoping for. You can keep them to 120, and that means that Kerry are gonna have to go above that, and there's very few teams in the country against those Dublin backs that are capable of scoring more than 120. And I think Kerry are one of those teams, but the trick is, you know, can you stop them from scoring 225? You know, that's where the whole thing is going to be won and lost, I suppose.
There's a small argument that Dublin's defence hasn't been overly tested, where they didn't really have a proper game until they played Mayo. And as Mike alluded to, Mayo's forwards, you know, probably wouldn't be the creme de la creme in Gaelic football. But this is a test. And if you are bringing on lads to, you know, to basically catch a high ball in the last 10 minutes, you're still touch and go, which obviously they will do. I think they will find this Dublin defence will be tested, and I'm not 100% sure they'll live up to their billing as this great full back line either, because they're taking on some of the proper stars of Gaelic football here, which really hasn't been the case this summer.
But sure, this is the whole thing about it, like if Kerry go into the game, as a lot of teams do against Dublin, poking around at it and hedging bets and all that kind of stuff, they will be in trouble early on. Kerry need, and this has been said by several people during the week, they need to bring fire and brimstone, but in an organised way, not in a chaotic way at it. And as you said, John, test this Dublin defence, see what they are made of, rather than letting them see what you're made of. Then that's when it could get interesting.
And as well as that, Mike, the midfield is going to be fascinating, because as you mentioned, Moran is having an outstanding campaign. Fenton's influence in the game is going to be colossal. You know, do Kerry need to win the midfield battle to win?
Around that middle sector is going to be crucial, obviously. Like, I mean, Fenton for me is the best footballer in the country. You know,
yeah, I agree.
He's just, you know, he's everything he does is just classy. There's no streak of a blackguard in the guy. You know, he's hardy, he's physical, but Jesus, what a silky footballer! You know, kick passer, scoring. I'll feel the ball over you. I'll show you a bit of leadership. Like he's just, if there was a transfer market anywhere in the GAA, he's your number one guy on everybody's list, because he doesn't just affect games. Like he just completely and utterly changes the way teams play, because he is so effective in his role. I don't think Dave Moran is going to be anywhere near him. I think it's going to be like Jack Barry will probably, whether he's named or not, I'd be surprised if Jack Barry isn't marking him.
And Jack Barry has done well against him traditionally as well.
He has, you know, in the past three times they've played each other. I think Fenton scored 1 point in three games from, you know, there was two of those were league games and stuff as well now. And I don't think anybody's realistically saying, look, he's gonna completely nullify his influence in the game, because the guy is too good a footballer for that. But you can imagine Jack Barry will probably be given the job to just try and dog him for about 50 minutes and be really physical and in his face and break ball. And he can run with him, and he can, you know, he'll compete with him for that kind of time. But the guy is too good to just keep him out of a game for 70 or 80 minutes. And it's going to be like Michael Darrow will probably pick up Dave Moran. And it's which one of those on the other matchup can be more influential. I just think the way Moran is playing, he's playing some of the best football he's ever played. And his kick passing, like they're different types of guys. He'll still get scores, Moran, but it's just the way he threads the whole Kerry play and gets ball from the back. And he's like, he doesn't give away a ball anymore. And a couple of years ago, he would have been trying these, you know, 50-yard outside of the boot balls into a guy with, you know, a small little window. Whereas they don't happen anymore now, and it's all sensible and smart stuff. And
there's an adage in field games, be it Gaelic football or soccer or rugby, whatever, win the middle of the field and you win the game. And that will be as true next Sunday as it is any other day.
As well as that, Michael, like, and I have said this before, Mayo were so deliberate in their possession. You won't have Moran humming and hawing about what to do with the ball. It's quick fastball into the forward line and take it from there. Now, the more the show goes on, there's an element of us talking Kerry into having a chance in this game, which we might make us look daft. But the bottom line is it is Kerry, and they do have the footballers to actually rack up a decent score anyway, at the very least.
I saw a little article with Colm Cooper there, I think, yesterday, in which he was saying that Kerry people, what he actually said was, Kerry people wouldn't accept if Kerry got a drubbing in the match, that they expect more of them. But for even somebody from Kerry, like Colm, to be even thinking along that way, that would worry me slightly. Because I think there is a realisation in a lot of people just how good this Dublin team are. And I mean, that's only facing up to the facts of it, you know. So this is the unknown in this factor. We're saying Kerry are a great county. They won't crumble. They'll put it up to the Dubs. They'll do this, that and the other thing. You don't know until that ball is thrown in how this thing is going to psychologically play out.
That's the thing. And Mike, you mentioned they blew them away against Mayo. Like, I was watching a documentary on RT about Tiananmen Square the other day, and you couldn't help but kind of draw in parallels of a 5-minute quelling of an uprising in the second half, where it was like, game over, gone. The cheek of you to even think you had a chance. Did that?
Mind you, in fairness, Johnny, if one fella has a tank and the other fella has a rose in his hand, it's not looking great.
I don't know what Kerry had, but I don't know what Mayo had anyway, but it was just, like, that that was 5 minutes of football for me. That I met Nathan Murphy at half time and we were in great form, met a couple of lads. Everyone who wants football to go on for the next few years and be competitive had this kind of renewed spirit gone. Now, was that 5 or 10 minutes to me was a bit scary, because it was probably the best 2 minutes of football I've ever seen at any level. And because it's Dublin, they mightn't get the credit for that, because everyone is kind of saying, well, it's Dublin. But that would worry me.
Oh, it was eye-watering stuff. Like, you're shaking your head, because everybody had that same sense at halftime. Everybody was getting a little bit too excited with themselves, and you know, and they were saying, even if Mayo don't win this game, they're after showing here now that these Dubs are vulnerable, and whether it's Kerry or Tyrone come out of the other semi-final, there's going to be a competitive final. And then within 5 or 10 minutes of that second half, you're just shaking your head saying, how is this after happening? And like, I'm not sure about, and Dublin were unbelievable in that period of time without even Jack McCaffrey being an influence in the game, who's such a threat again on Sunday. But they were just devastating, led by Fenton. But the big thing that they did against Mayo, and they're obviously going to do it to Shane Ryan the next day, who's a rookie goalkeeper, and they do it every time. Their most effective attacking platform is on the opposition's kick-out, every time. And like, they're going to do the same thing next Sunday. They're going to push 12 bodies into the Kerry half, and they're going to try and cut out any little short kick-out that Shane Ryan has on and force him to put the ball up for grabs. And they're just so good at outnumbering, you know, Kerry now the next day, and try and get around that pitch of the ball. And that's one of their biggest, you know, platforms. But I'm just not sure about Mayo. I mean, I watched Kerry and Mayo in the first round of the Super 8, and Kerry blew them out of the water as well. And they did it from the first half. And I just said, okay, maybe, you know, Mayo after coming through the qualifiers, the legs are probably spent a little bit. Maybe that's not a great barometer of where Kerry were. And then Dublin did the same thing in the second half. And I'm just not sure if Mayo are actually the, you know, an appropriate barometer to say, Jesus, Dublin were actually unbelievable. When I saw Kerry do the same thing in Killarney, and that's something else that's kind of giving Kerry people a little bit of hope. Well, we did the same thing to them, but we actually did it over 70 minutes, whereas Dublin only did it over 35. So,
and it's also, you know, interesting. It's also interesting, Mike, that the Kilkenny team in its prime did this kind of stuff. They get into tight matches, and there was a kind of a pattern there. Towards the end of the first half, they might pick off a score or two just so the gap wasn't too big at halftime, even if they were in trouble. And you think to yourself, this is going to be interesting. They're in for a right battle here now in the second half. And they go out in the second half, and within 10 minutes, the opposition would be lying flat on their backs on the ground. And Kilkenny were so good at that, the way the Dubs can do that now. However, Kilkenny didn't win the 5 in a row.
They didn't. And as well as that, traditionally finals are close. You know, last year even it was 6 points when I don't think anyone believed Tyrone, whereas there's a little expectation Kerry could give them a game. Finals are finals, they're probably an abstract thing. And if you were going into the game, Mike, I think you're 39 now, is it?
About that, yeah.
Sometimes we have dreams about that. We're back on the pitch or whatever, and about that, and hopefully, okay, you're not playing if you're 39. Say you're 29, right? 10 years, but you're coming into this game. Is there any fear? Are you afraid of what might happen? Who you're marking?
No fear. No, I think this is absolutely just an absolutely gorgeous situation for Kerry. I mean, like, if you go back to the last 37 All-Irelands that Kerry have won, I would guarantee you there has been no time that Kerry have been such an underdog as they are right now. And if you're a player inside that group, or you're Peter Keane, who's thrown out every kind of pishog he can find, and is, you know, leading a merry little dance there for everybody, and like gives the impression that he hasn't a clue what's maybe going on. Like, these fellas are coming in, like, the grass is so far over their head, like, nobody can see them. And I just think, from a Kerry point of view, whether they win the game or not, like, everything is set up for them to perform and give a really good account to themselves. And I think you've got guys now like Tommy Wells, for example. I mentioned him already. Tommy is a guy now, like, who, like, the semi-final against Tyrone, that 25 minutes or whatever he played and how effective he was, like, that's after sending him into the next 3 weeks into this final, like, just floating on air now. And I can just imagine, like, the leadership and the talk and everything that he's given that dressing room. Same with the likes of David Moore, you know, your Paul Murphys, your Paul Ganeys, like, those big kind of leaders now, big characters in that dressing room, are just salivating at the chance to get out here and have a crack at these boys, because they'll know, like, you mentioned the full back line earlier, Johnny, like, that full back line that started in the All-Ireland final for Dublin last year, it's highly likely that none of them will play next Sunday. That was Owen Merton, I think, maybe Keane O'Sullivan, possibly Philly McMahon. Like, none of them may play from Sunday. So that'll tell you that that if there's any line in the Dublin team that they're maybe unsure about, it's probably that full back line, and that's probably Kerry's best line and strongest line, and they'll know that and they'll recognise that this is our best chance to win this game, to get as many possessions as we can from our own kickouts and from theirs, and to just really attack flat out as much as we can. And if you get beat, you get beat, but at least they'll, you know, as the saying goes, they'll probably try and die with their boots on.
And that has to be, I think, also worrying Jim Gavin going into this match. The fact that Kerry are being written off by a lot of people, or if they're not actually being written off, then clearly Dublin are going to be the favourites.
Well, virtually nobody will predict they'll win.
Exactly, yeah. And if you ask me right here now, in a minute, my prediction, I probably will be going for Dublin. And as I said, Jim, that has to be a concern for Jim Gavin, the fact that this is the situation, because that can get into a mindset with players. No matter how hard you try to avoid it, it can happen. And that's a factor in it. It may not be the deciding factor, but it's another factor in the equation.
I don't know, Mike. Give us some sort of a prediction.
Actually, look, I mean, again, if you put me on the block and say, listen, you know, like I think until you see Dublin beaten, you can't say that Dublin aren't going to win it. You know, I think Dublin are capable of blowing Kerry out. They're capable of winning a tight game. But I also think, like, I wouldn't have given Tyrone any sniff last year. I didn't think they had a prayer of beating Dublin because they didn't have the arsenal. Whereas Kerry have the arsenal that if everything goes right for them, they're in a position to win this game. They could possibly be a team that win this game by a point or two, or take it to a replay or something. I think if everything goes right, that's Kerry's best case scenario, that they sneak it by a point. But the other two scenarios see Dublin winning, and you know, you can't go against them until you see somebody actually drive a stake through their hat. So
yeah, just hypothetically, so finally, Dublin win by 10 points. Where is Gaelic football?
Not in a good place.
Mike,
not in a good place.
I think with all, I even speak to a lot of Dublin fans, I think, who are, you know, as much as they're enjoying this, they do want a competitive kind of playing field. But Mike, it'd be lovely to have you on next week, reminiscing about how much you got it right. I think you've kind of slightly hedged your bets a little bit, but I think you've given us hope anyway, and great to talk to you.
No bother, Royce. Take it easy.
See you, Mike.
I was down in Kerry a couple of weeks ago. Can put love the place for one thing. Popped into Waterville, and obviously Mikko's statue was there, and Charlie Chaplin. You probably sound like Charlie Chaplin if you're trying to predict a Kerry victory here. But Mikko was that close to 5 in a row.
Yeah.
And he knows the dangers. And,
of course he does.
The Dublin players know that. They say they're not going to say it, but they know they're on the cusp of something historic here, and maybe there's a crumb of comfort for Kerry in that.
I do, but you know, the thing about it is, a lot of people read psychological things into all of these situations, but that bid for 5 in a row by that Kerry team in 1982, let's face facts here. A fairly fluky goal at the end of the game by Seamus Darby changed the dynamic of that
game. Don't think he was going for
one shot, kind of, you know what I mean? And had that not happened, Kerry would have won their 5 in a row. They would have won it narrowly, because Offaly had actually put up a great performance that day, but they would have won it, and everybody would have been saying, sure, we always knew that was going to happen, sure, the greatest team that ever existed and all that. So this is the point about it. We don't know the things that would happen on the day that would change the dynamic of this game. Mike was saying there, if everything goes right with Kerry, and maybe one or two things go wrong with Dublin, then Kerry have a chance. But that's what it comes down to, that feeling that Kerry have to have everything right, and maybe Dublin might be just a gnats off the pace. But all things being equal, if Kerry play well and if Dublin play well,
Dublin win.
Dublin will win this match.
If you go back to the last time they lost game in the championship against Donegal, they should have been out of sight at one stage, and then Donegal had this kind of rally. Kerry need goals, 100%. They need to score goals. Mayo never really looked like scoring until the game was over.
Tom Cooper, I referenced him there a moment ago in his preview of this match and his predictions about it. He said, Kerry need 3 goals on Sunday. Now, jeepers, I can't see where Kerry are going to get 3 goals against Dublin.
That is worrying, but I think, Without going into complete hyperbole, I think Gaelic football's future is somewhat at stake here, because everyone wants Kerry to at least be competitive, because if Dublin blow them out the water, you know, with the bench Dublin have, with the resources, the funding that we hear about all the time, you are possibly looking at the end of the inter-county setup, because people just completely lose interest.
Yeah, that is a possibility. But the one thing that I would say to you about all of that kind of situation, let's see what happens in the match first before we go into that. Usually on the Monday after the All-Ireland football final, I meet up with a bunch of my mates, as I'm going to do on Monday next as well, as we do a debrief on the championship. And I can tell you there'll be some rubbish talked at that at the end of it all. We'll discuss the state of Gaelic football for you on Monday. But first of all, let's see what happens in this All-Ireland final. It ain't Dublin's problem and it ain't Jim Gavin's problem what the state of Gaelic football is. And that's one for another day, if you like. What we're facing here is what kind of a fist can Kerry make of this? And the other thing, by the way, that we're looking at on Sunday is, which you haven't actually, Johnny, mentioned so far.
You're chastising me now. I know Michael Lesser.
I'm just bringing you around here.
You've had years of experience.
The Galway Minors are in action next Sunday.
Yes. I've a lot of hope for Galway for the future. Yeah. And we look forward to that. I don't have a ticket at the moment. I don't think Michael has either. Right. So if this isn't a plea, I don't know what is. But in any event, great.
You know where to contact us. Two will do.
Yeah, great to have you on.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Enjoyed it.
And that's just about our lot for this hour. A reminder that the Drive for Five special is taking over OTB Sports Radio all day from 7 a.m. to midnight. We have another 6 hours left with build-up to the All-Ireland Football Final, all with thanks to Tech7. Simply tech it and leave it. Coming up over the next hour, Nathan Murphy, the poor Nathan Murphy, who for so long, at least half an hour, thought Mayo had a chance of beating Dublin. He'll be going through the combined Kerry-Dublin side as picked by some GA legends. We leave you for now with Judge Brian McMahon, who joined us earlier to talk about former teammate Mick O'Connell. Thanks for listening.
And the four in a row has been achieved by Dublin.
This is GAA from Off the Ball.
We're getting very excited. We're taking over the airwaves from 7 a.m. all the way until midnight. There must be something big on, Joe.
It's the Dublin Drive for Five, Chair.
Six All-Ireland titles in 8 years.
This is OTB Sports Radio.